You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the Missouri National Education Association and IBEW Local 1464. The Missouri National Education Association serves as the united voice of educators and advocates for the rights of students, educators, and working families across Missouri. The 32,000 members of the Missouri National Education Association work each day to inspire students' love of learning and ensure every child, regardless of zip code, can attend a great public school. And IBEW Local 1464 reminds all union members to support each other and encourage all workers to buy union and American-made products. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, the not-yet-confirmed new Secretary of Labor, Marty Walsh, will be the first in decades to actually come from organized labor. What could that mean for American workers? And as the new Biden administration begins to undo Trump's anti-asylum policies, new caravans of migrants are already coming from Central America. Why do they come? What changes would let them be able to stay home? And will Biden's new policies make a difference? In the news, Coke-connected union buster hired by Amazon to bust Alabama Workers Union. And Chicago Teachers Union President Kieran Lewis dies of cancer. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Blackman. Now for the news.
House, the National Labor Relations Board has denied Amazon's attempt to delay the vote and ruled that it can be conducted by mail. Ballots were sent out February 8th to about 5,800 workers at Amazon's Bessemer Fulfillment Center near Birmingham, Alabama. Amazon had argued that a mail-in election would take too long and involve too many resources. Instead, Amazon wanted a four-day in-person election to be held in the parking lot. The NLRB, however, said no, not during a pandemic. The workers are voting to join the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, the RWDSU. No one should be surprised that Amazon is running a vigorous union-busting campaign with an anti-union website. Facebook adds anti-union classes, which intimidate anyone expressing a contrary opinion, as well as sending workers texts claiming that unionizing means, quote, giving up the right to speak for yourself and costing, quote, you money for nothing. This is all despite Alabama being a right to freeload state, meaning that no one will be forced to join the union or pay dues. Yesterday, The Intercept reported that Amazon is paying anti-union consultant Russell Brown, head of RWP Labor, $3,200 per day plus expenses for his work. Brown also serves as the president of the Center for Independent Employees, a think tank that has received funding from billionaire Koch Network that routinely lobbies to weaken the political power of labor unions. The RWDSU has said that Amazon has also enrolled workers into classes in which instructors have attempted to scare workers about the supposed dangers of unionization with false claims that unionization may decrease wages. According to a report from Wired, when workers challenged these claims, some were called to the front of the room where their badges were photographed in an apparent attempt at intimidation.
The Chicago Teachers Union, which represents 25,000 teachers and educational support personnel working in Chicago public schools, released the following statement on Tuesday regarding the passing of President Emerita Karen Lewis. It said, "Our union is mourning today at the passing of our sister, our leader, and our friend, President Emerita Karen G.J. Lewis. Karen taught us how to fight. She taught us how to love. She was a direct descendant of the legendary Jackie Vaughn, the first Black female president of our local. Both were fierce advocates for educators and children, but where Jackie and with stately elegance, Karen was a brawler and a sharp wit and an Ivy League education. She spoke three languages, loved her opera and her show tunes, and dazzled you with her smile, yet could stare down the most powerful enemies of public education and defend our institution with a force rarely seen in organized labor. She bowed to no one. She gave strength to tens of thousands of Chicago teacher union educators who followed her lead and live by her principles to this day. But Karen did not just lead our movement, she was our movement. In 2013, she said that in order to change public education in Chicago, we had to change Chicago, change the political landscape of our city, and Chicago had changed because of her. We have more fighters for justice and equity because of Karen and because she was a champion, the people's champion. Lewis dared to oppose Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and school board intent on curbing union power in 2012, when she would led the teachers out on strike at the beginning of the school year. The union won because of its solidarity and strong support of the families of the kids. She made the quality of education the center point of the strike. University of Illinois Labor Studies Professor Bob Bruno told the Chicago Sun-Times, "Karen did something which hadn't been done in some time, and that she has really challenged the popular understanding about public schools."
Did anyone else react in dismay at the Squarespace ad during the Super Bowl, which ripped off the classic feminist tune, 9 to 5? Squarespace even got the song's originator, Dolly Parton, to commit the sacrilege. Both Jessica Bennett in the New York Times and David Sirota squared off against it. The ad for Squarespace suggested women use the hours after work from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., or maybe it's 9 a.m., to get a new hustle, presumably using Squarespace to build a website to sell it. The jingle went, "Yeah, 9 to 5, you've got passion and vision, cause it's hustling time, whole new way to make a living. Gonna change your life, do something that gives it meaning with a website that is worthy of your dreaming." Bennett said, "Indeed, Americans are hustling more than ever in the pandemic, but not in the same way. In a global recession that disproportionately affects women and has working mothers coming apart at the seams, many people are simply trying to stay afloat." Sirota was outraged. He advises people to think about what's in the ad. He says, "You saw Inatech drones slogging through the drudgery of the eight-hour day. And then the moment the clock struck 5, they didn't go home to family, nor did they head to happy hour with friends. They flipped open laptops for the next day's for their next work day, presumably necessary, not just for a bit of work satisfaction, but also for survival in a paycheck-to-paycheck economy." He says the original 9 to 5 song was about women protesting who get slave wages. This ad advises us to lengthen the workday. Maybe it's just an ad, but it's a commentary on how corporate America manipulates working people. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Sean Saving, Christina Dismang, and I'm Judy Ansel.
For the first time since the Ford administration, the Department of Labor is likely to be led by someone with strong ties to organized labor. Marty Walsh, Current mayor of Boston is President Biden's pick to head the department in charge of enforcing the nation's labor laws. Before becoming a mayor, Walsh headed up the Boston Building Trades Council. He is also past president of Laborers Local 223, the union in which he got his start. The child of Irish immigrants, Walsh cuts an old-school labor aesthetic that would seem to fit well with Biden's self-styled image as champion of the working man. But is there more to this appointment than appearances? Certainly having someone with an actual background in the labor movement will be beneficial to working people, right? But what powers does the Secretary of Labor actually have? And what does this say about Biden's approach to rebuilding the economy and the power of labor? Since we're talking about a Boston guy, we thought we would ask someone who has had a much closer view of the career of Marty Walsh. Joining us tonight is Nicholas Jurevich, Assistant Professor of History and Labor Studies and Associate Director of the Labor Resources Center at the Center at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Professor Jurevich, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hey, thanks for having me, and you can call me Nick.
Nick, all right, Nick, thank you, Marin. What does it mean for workers to have someone from labor heading the Department of Labor now? And what does this say about President Biden's priorities?
I think it's exciting. And of course, it's exciting in part because when administrations switch now from the GOP to the Democrats, it means the Department of Labor will actually do what it's supposed to. This is a department that was created to advocate for workers, to enforce the rights of workers. And really, since the Reagan era, it hasn't when the GOP is in charge. And that's gotten worse and worse and was particularly disastrous with Eugene Scalia at the helm over the last couple of years. And at a time when, you know, this is the department that is responsible for overseeing the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and we are in the midst of a global pandemic, to have someone who's actively committed to reducing regulatory measures in charge of the Department of Labor was a disaster for workers all over. So, that's maybe a really low bar to set, but it is exciting that we have someone who will make the department run. The other thing that's exciting, I think, is Marty Walsh is somebody who comes out of specifically the building trades, where misclassification, where occupational safety and health, and where unemployment and underemployment are major issues. So he said this in his confirmation hearing, and it's true. He knows firsthand what these issues look like, how they impact working families, how they impacted his own family. So he's got both a kind of compelling story to tell about why the Department of Labor needs to do its job and a mandate to make it do it. So we hope that he will.
So do you think, you know, you mentioned there that, you know, there's a history that, especially in our lifetimes, that Republican administrations appoint sort of antagonists of labor at the best in this position. Democrats will appoint somebody who's labor friendly, but they haven't been from labor. They've been, you know, academics, politicians. Do you think that besides his background, do you think that this is going to be a different, he's going to treat the department, or he's going to be a labor secretary that's different than previous nominees, and how might he be a different type of labor secretary?
So it's hard to say, right? Because a lot of the work he'll be doing, I think, is about making the administration do what it should. This is an administrative post. But I do think, that first off, the fact that this was a high profile appointment mattered. I don't remember this level of excitement or sort of horse race coverage around any of Obama's appointees or Clinton's appointees. And the fact that, you know, this was both considered a high profile appointment and one that's going to be connected to Biden's larger priorities around building back better, his economic plan for industry and infrastructure, suggests that this is going to be a position that is meant to have a bully pulpit. And that's, I think, a role where, you know, Biden picked someone who very much captures his image of the labor movement, and there are limits to that, but also someone who is comfortable, right, walking picket lines, who is comfortable speaking in union halls, and hopefully will get out and do that. I will say one other thing that's interesting, the sort of second place person for this post was Julie Hsu out of California. Just today or yesterday, the news was that she's going to be appointed assistant labor secretary. So someone who has a completely different set of experiences, comes out, you know, of the world of labor law, but has done a ton of work around gig economy work with undocumented workers, and was, you know, praised by many people on the left and in those communities for that reason, is also going to be on board here. So we are going to have a really high profile, empowered labor department. And hopefully they will use that bully pulpit, I think.
Interesting. I guess I should mention, just today I read before we came on the air, Walsh has passed, he has passed out of the initial committee, 18-4 vote. So it looks like he's going to get a lot of, he has at least the support of Republicans on that committee. He's likely to sail through a nomination process when that happens sometime, assumingly. soon after the impeachment is over. So let's talk a little bit about what Marty can actually do. As a head of a federal agency, he has no authority to make new laws. That's Congress's purview. But he will oversee the administration of existing laws, as you mentioned, as well as regulations that implement those laws. So what do you think Walsh's top priorities should be upon taking office?
You know, so it was interesting, both listening to his testimony and sort of hearing other people talk about him. He's someone who's committed to labor and sort of the government as part of this, providing social safety nets. So I think his first priority is going to be the pandemic and health and safety, but also really making sure that unemployed, underemployed folks are getting access to the resources they need to keep their families afloat. I think one place where people really want to push him is around the question of classification. And he has a lot of latitude there as labor secretary, and the department does, because there are lots of good laws on the books. There's a lot of debate around how new workers should be classified, what authority the department has to do that. But to come out strongly saying, look, we are going to classify people as workers under the Fair Labor Standards Act for the purposes of overtime and unemployment as widely as possible, and then to actually get out and stump for that, would be really powerful. And of course, it would run up against, hopefully not run aground, the gig economy companies, right? So these, the major sort of folks who just funded Prop 22 in California will be against that kind of move. So that would be a political move, it would be a challenged move, but it would be a really good one for workers.
Yeah, and there's a lot to do. I mean, we were already headed in this direction of more and more people becoming a gig worker. This pandemic is only going to make that worse. It's accelerated that move because this is going to be the only work a lot of people are going to be able to find. And boy, Silicon Valley is just trying to figure out another way they can turn a regular job into an app somewhere that you have to work on call for somebody else. I expect to see a proliferation of new at-will employment opportunities, if you could call them that, as this economy starts to recover. It seems that we've been hearing a lot about the need for a massive investment in infrastructure for decades. I mean, this goes back to when I was just in high school. They talked about how bad our infrastructure was in the United States. Of course, that's going to require Congress to actually pass a bill. What role do you see at Walsh as the Department of Labor Secretary to be able to play in that process? And what would you have him do if you were President Biden?
Well, around the question of infrastructure, of course, there'll be a lot of support across the board, right? Infrastructure is popular across a wide swath of working folks, across a wide swath of the political spectrum. When it comes to industrial policy, which is something else that Biden's focused on and connected to his infrastructure policy, one place where you hope Marty Walsh will be able to really prove pivotal is talking to folks in his neck of the woods in the labor movement, the building trades and others, about the importance of green infrastructure and green investment. So he was asked about the cancellation of the pipeline in his hearing, and he supported that. Obviously, there are people in the building trades, there are others who've been really critical of that. He's positioned, hopefully, to help advocate for what's sometimes called a Green New Deal. That's not the language the administration's using now, but to advocate for a green industrial policy and a green infrastructure policy, and selling that to the unions and the people who will do that work. So,
well, I mean, some of us, I think, in the far left of the labor movement would call that the just transition.
Yes, yes.
That term doesn't get out into the public very much, but I think we might start to hear that more as we go forward. Is there has to be a way to transition folks from these old fossil fuel industries into new jobs, new job training. I want to let everybody know you are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Sean Saving. I'm talking with Professor Nick Jurevich, Associate Director of the Labor Resources Center at University of Massachusetts, Boston, about President Biden's nomination of Marty Walsh to head the Department of Labor. Two of the big priorities for labor, Nick, are the PRO Act, which we've talked about on this show before, and which would greatly reform laws regarding union organizing, and also raising the minimum wage, which looks like it may not end up in this new stimulus COVID relief bill. Again, both will require congressional action. So where does the Secretary of Labor come in on those two fronts?
Well, so for me, what's exciting about both of those are that those are moves that will aid not just unionized workers or workers in one sector. They will vastly expand the power of working people, and they articulate a vision for the working class. I hope that as Secretary Marty Walsh can sort of make the leap from, you know, we are the enforcement agency and we are the administrative agency for working people to saying, you know, we need to expand the rights and opportunities that we can offer to working people as a whole. And I think that is a challenge for anybody in that role to emphasize that, you know, we need the PRO Act, not just for people who are already unionized. We need it so that more people can be unionized. You know, we need the minimum wage to come up to $15 an hour for everyone. And of course, Marty was very supportive of that here in Boston. That's not something he's unfamiliar with at all. And the PRO Act will be tougher to get through Congress. And that will require a willingness, obviously, to, you know, do away with the filibuster most likely. And we'll see what comes of that. But I do think the idea that you can jump from sort of doing well as an administrator to articulating a vision of that administration that's actually for all working people and not just for particular sectors or particular unions, that'll be the sort of the leap we want to see Marty make, I think.
I think that's the question here, I think, too, is you've got a guy who comes out of the building trades, which is a traditionally, you know, a more conservative aspect, you know, one of the more conservative factions of the labor movement, particularly among its membership, you know, often criticized for being very pro-development, which runs afoul of a lot of the environmental side of the left, some of the other, and you know, folks who are concerned about gentrification and affordability in their cities. So obviously, he's going to have maybe some pull with some folks in the business community, then including the Republican Party or what's left of the Rational Republican Party. Do you think that some of the movement wanted Biden to appoint somebody a little more closely reflecting of the modern working class movement, you know, a person of color, maybe somebody who has service industry background, recent immigrant, a woman? You know, you think that criticism is warranted? You think Walsh understands these issues and concerns of the modern, largely unorganized workforce?
Well, I think both things can be true, right? I think it was absolutely reasonable to push Biden to see the labor movement more broadly than he does. Harold Meyerson, in a piece back in the Atlantic Prospect in December, pointed out that Biden's favorite way to refer to unions is, carpenters, bricklayers, and boilermakers, which surely describes Scranton in his day, but how many Americans know what a boilermaker is? I'm just cribbing this straight from Harold Meyerson, I should cite him. But in that same piece, he argued that Julie Sue would actually be, in some ways, a modern-day Frances Perkins, that this was someone who came out of labor law but was deeply connected to the struggles of immigrant workers on the front lines of the new economy. And now here she is going to be assistant labor secretary. And the fact that she was willing to join, you know, not having gotten the top spot, I hope suggests that this labor department will be empowered to really, you know, and she will be a major part of it. She's not going to be just a second in command. But to go back to Marty, you're absolutely right. You know, the building trades have a long and checkered history. The last union leader, not just union member, but union leader to hold the post Marty has was absolutely reactionary guy, Peter Brennan of New York, who led the hard hat riots, didn't lead, instigated, maybe is the right word, and who in his role as labor secretary was so reactionary, George Meany hated him. And who, by the way, one of his failings was not raising the minimum wage, which he had promised and Nixon had promised would happen. And if you look at the distance between Brennan and Walsh, I think you do see a really significant evolution in the building trades. And here in Boston, you know, Marty takes credit for, rightly so, being part of the folks in that movement who have pushed to better integrate and better expand the diversity of their apprenticeship programs. Those unions really have changed. And at the same time, he's an old school guy and he looks like an old school guy. And so there is a question of representation here. What I will say just finally about that is that as mayor, right, not as a building trades leader, but as mayor, Marty Walsh has been on the picket lines with Unite Here Local 26. He's been on the picket lines with the UFCW at Stop and Shop. And of course, Biden was there too, as were many politicians. So he knows what the modern labor movement looks like. He's walked their picket lines. He's met with their leaders. Hopefully those kind of connections are coming with him to Washington, as well as his background in the trades.
Well, this should be encouraging to folks in the labor movement. And I think to all unorganized workers as well, to have an actual advocate and somebody who is out front. I mean, I don't even think, you know, anybody even knows who the Department of Labor secretary ever is or what they do. And I guess I'm encouraged here to think that maybe we're actually going to know something about, we might know who Marty Walsh is. He might actually become somebody that some folks actually can recognize. I want to mention there's more to labor's struggles here with the law than just the Department of Labor. There's also the National Labor Relations Board, and that's a separate entity. It's independent of the Department of Labor. Can you briefly just let people know, like, where the NLRB fits into all of this? And, you know, Marty has no control over them. Do we know anything about Biden's picks for NLRB yet? Or where are we at on? We've got a couple minutes here.
So what we've seen with the NLRB is, of course, firing the counsel, right? Who is this reactionary, and it was the first time someone had been fired in a while, but it was exactly the right call. And the NLRB is the oversight board for union elections and for figuring out sort of the size of bargaining units, determining who's a worker within those bargaining units, these kinds of questions. And then they set precedents that Marty and the Department of Labor follow. But of course, they have limited jurisdiction. And they also only have jurisdiction when people bring cases through their regional boards to the national board. So they're really important, but they're also not so much of a day-to-day entity, right? Making these decisions on the ground will often be the Department of Labor's call when it comes to questions of classification, questions of occupational health and safety. But one does hope that the Biden NLRB, and of course, this is another political football, it transforms each administration. I was a grad worker at Columbia when we were, you know, petitioning the Obama board to overturn the Bush ruling, which had overturned the ruling under Clinton regarding grad students. So this is, it's a real problem for the labor movement that the NLRB only does what it's supposed to do half the time. But hopefully it will over the next 4 years and perhaps beyond.
Well, Nick, I want to thank you for being on the show. I think this has been a great discussion. I hope people have learned a little bit about I'm excited just the fact that we actually have somebody who's involved with labor running the Department of Labor for a change. I think that could be just invaluable. So I want to appreciate you. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I was talking with Nicholas Yurevich, history and labor studies professor at the University of Massachusetts Boston. I'm Sean Saving, and you are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Hi, this is Mary Girlt and some of the characters I play on Shots in the Night Radio Theater.
Karen Jombley, pet home decorator to the stars, and my Siamese twin sister.
Sharon. I'm Sharon, and I'm very supportive.
Senora Flora Maria Consuelo Evita Benita Dorita Soledad Vega.
Hannibal Boone, the oldest woman in Missouri.
Join me and my favorite characters on Shots in the Night at 7 p.m. on the second Thursday of each month.
Thanks for listening to KKFI. Be sure to like and follow your community radio station on social media at KKFI 901 FM. And thanks for 30 years of support.
Entre en la casa de la justicia de mi país y comprobé que es un templo de encantadores, de serpientes.
And next up, Christina. Christina?
Good evening. I'm Christina Disming. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight, we are going to be listening to a segment of Karen Springs' podcast, Honduras Now. In this segment, we will be getting an update on the recent January 15th caravan and what, if any, impact the Biden administration has had on migration issues coming out of Honduras. Will there be change or just more of the same?
Are you all?
U.S. President Joe Biden began his presidency by implementing a series of measures aimed at reversing years of racist Trump-era immigration policy designed to appeal to white supremacists. The Biden administration has said that it intends to end migrant protection protocols, better known as Remain in Mexico, that saw thousands of asylum seekers forced to live in horrific camps on the Mexican side of the border while they waited for their hearings that would determine if they would be granted asylum in the United States. Biden has also promised to attend to the so-called root causes of migration. But these promises towards the people of Central America by Biden have been made and broken before. The challenge boils down to this. Migrant justice activists and the Biden administration have a very different understanding as to what the root causes of migration are. Based on what Biden proposed, both in 2014 and during his presidential campaign, Biden seems to simply want to entrench the power further of the Honduran oligarchs and also cement the neoliberal development model in Honduras. And this has been the true cause of the Honduran exodus. We discuss more about Biden's policies in more detail in episode 11. But let's hear from Bartolo Fuentes, who's a journalist, a migrant human rights defender, and an opposition politician. Bartolo tells us that the only way migration from his country will be stopped will be if the United States government ends its support for the Juan Orlando Hernández dictatorship.
Aquí hay un flujo permanente de migrantes y que solo podría terminar cuando nos vayamos todos, ¿verdad? Y eso no podría ser.
There is a permanent flow of migrants, and it will only end when we all leave to go north. And that can't happen. So while conditions are not improved here in the country, the flow of migrants will not stop. And in the United States, Donald Trump was endorsing this government that significantly worsened the living conditions for people and that generated a lot of migration. It would be better if the border wall didn't exist, but it would be even better if no one felt obligated to leave Honduras. And by changing the conditions here, that's how you will stop migration. One of the causes that make people leave is because they don't have any hope. In Honduras, people aren't hopeful because the government is doing harm. Or they just rob. They stole all the funds from the social security system, money from the health ministry, from agriculture, education, lots of institutions. For the government, the pandemic has been another opportunity to continue to steal, to purchase mobile hospitals that never got here. The government purchased mobile hospitals for the health emergency, but they still aren't up and running. They cost $48 million in a country where there is a lot of need, but where there is permanent theft from the state. The U.S. knows this well, and they tolerate it because this president supports the U.S.'s international policies. And then you look at the Honduran government's involvement in organized crime. Everyone knows that President Juan Orlando Hernández got to his position with money from drug cartels. And then later, he wanted to turn himself and his political party into the only cartel operating in Honduras by declaring war on the other cartels. This week, on January 27th, the president's brother was supposed to be sentenced in a New York court. The president himself has been mentioned like 60 times in documents presented by U.S. prosecutors. They even refer to him as CC4. So, when are these prosecutors going to indict him? Or will the U.S. Southern Command just continue to politically support Juan Orlando Hernández? People are discouraged, so they leave the country. The U.S. immigration policies don't act alone. We would be really happy if Biden legalizes Honduras in the U.S. with TPS and the Dreamers. This is good. But more than just opening the borders to others, what we want is for conditions to be improved in our country. And that happens when the current government that we have, that is protected and backed by the U.S., is changed. There was a coup here. The armed forces of Honduras didn't take a single step without instructions or the go-ahead from the U.S. Southern Command. Southern Command is like a regional government that the U.S. has here to protect Honduras, to the point where they even publicly praise and recognize the president, give him medals and diplomas. That's how it is.
I frequently get asked how these migrant caravans get formed. People seem to want to know who organizes them, and how do people know what date they leave? Is it a political conspiracy? Are these people being paid to walk to the border to mess around with the political situation in the United States? Well, the answer to those questions is no. The caravans are formed by a combination of factors. One being that all it takes is a small group of people to say that they're leaving the country. They send that message or announcement to a WhatsApp group chat, and that message gets forwarded and forwarded from there. And when the departure date rolls around, as set out by that WhatsApp message, people just arrive to the planned point and they leave from there. Many people say, but tell them that they're being lied to. Tell them that the American dream doesn't exist and that they will face serious problems at the border. Do they know that? Do they know that it's hard to get across? My answer is yes. Hondurans know. They know it's dangerous. They know they might not make it, and they know that there is tremendous risk. But they're desperate and feel like leaving is the only way forward, that it's better to take the risk of dying or being detained or being kidnapped than staying here in the conditions in Honduras. The U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa puts out messages and tweets and has for many years since the caravan started, warning Hondurans about the dangers of traveling north. The messages warn that U.S. law will be used against them if asylum seekers or Hondurans violate it, and that they are being cheated. Commercials on major Honduran TV networks are frequently aired as well, repeating the same messages. The video clips warn people not to flee north and then use fear as the primary tactic to deter people. Here's a short clip in Spanish of former U.S. Charge d'Affaires Heidi Fulton, who was in charge of the U.S. Embassy for many years, warning people not to travel and what will happen if they do.
Este es un mensaje para los que están migrando hacia los Estados Unidos. Por favor, regresen a su país. Están siendo engañados con falsas promesas de parte de líderes con fines políticos y criminales.
It's hard to understand desperation and just how bad things have to be for Hondurans to make these decisions. But they're bad. The situation here is not easy. And people have no hope that it'll get better.
Toda esa tesis de conspiraciones, ¿verdad? Alrededor de las caravanas no tienen ningún fundamento.
All these conspiracy theories about the caravans don't have any basis. None. There are something like 8 or 9 different contradictory versions. They even accuse me of being a caravan organizer. And at one point, ironically, they accused me based on these theories. I told them that if they're going to slander me, that they needed to get their story straight. Because at one point, I was accused of paying people to go on the caravans. Others said that I was charging each migrant $1,000 or $1,500. So I asked them, what is it then? Am I paying them or charging them? But I had to defend myself from these inventions and accusations. Here, unfortunately, military intelligence has the capability to write an exaggerated story about how these caravans are formed. The last theory I heard was yesterday. Now they're trying to say that evangelical pastors are organizing the caravans. Good God. But it's true that in the caravans, there are people carrying Bibles and praying. I don't want to say that a pastor, who has some leadership amongst his people, are going to direct a group toward a caravan, or that he's an organizer. Do you want to know how the caravans are organized? It's simple. Listen. Here in northern Honduras, there is a large, fast-flowing river, the Ulua River. It's huge. But this river doesn't originate from one source. No one can say that the Ulua River originates at one single point. It starts from a ton of places and starts first as a brook that forms into a stream, which joins with the Chiquito River, which then pours into the Ulua River. This is the same for the caravans. People leave from different parts of the country, but from the same department. They don't all come from the same place. They come from different municipalities. From within a municipality, groups of 5, 6, or 8 people. Or from one village, 5, and another, 8, from another, 10. And they don't even know each other. At that level, there is an organizer who says, let's go, let's go. That's how I understand it, at least. So each person brings 5 or 6, or whatever small number with them. And a lot of the small groups are friends, cousins, or whatever. And they get together in one place. And later, they form into a big river, a crowd. But it's not just one person. They all get together, organized around a single date, a place, and a departure time. The Honduran government knows how this works. They know that the information spreads through WhatsApp. WhatsApp groups can have hundreds of people on them. But even then, these groups aren't the caravan. It's just where people confirm that the caravan is happening. So the caravans don't have a single organizer, but instead hundreds of organizers. The enormous needs that the people have, these are the momentum, or the motor, that drives the caravans. If it occurred to someone, right at this moment, to say that on February 14th, and I don't know what day of the week that is, that a caravan is going to leave, and that announcement is disseminated or someone has the courage to say publicly, people will show up. People will arrive to the departure point on that hour and on that date.
Around January 15th, several thousand Hondurans began gathering in the large bus terminal in the major northern industrial city of San Pedro Sula. Groups began leaving on foot, headed to the border, as early as January 14th in the evening. But the largest group left San Pedro Sula on January 15th. To try and stop the caravan or slow it down, police and military checkpoints were set up inside Honduran borders, and some even in the same department where the caravans gathered in the bus terminal. The State Security Force checkpoints stopped the migrants as they walked by, harassing them for documents or stopping large vehicles like trucks that were giving migrants a short ride. This is independent journalist Sandra Cuff, who was on the ground with the caravan after it crossed into Guatemala from Honduras. Sandra is based in Guatemala City and has covered many stories of the migrants participating in the caravans and has reported for the LA Times, The Guardian, and many other major news outlets.
So on January 15th, the first large group of the migrant caravan entered Guatemala and walked all night and into the following morning, January 16th, 27 miles into Guatemala from the El Florido border crossing to right around the village of Vado Hondo. So Guatemala had deployed hundreds of police and military in this sort of eastern region of Guatemala to border areas, to checkpoints, to the control points. And there was also significant deployment to Vado Hondo. That's where the government decided they were going to stop the caravan. So on Saturday, January 16th, by early-ish afternoon, I think, police lines and lines of military police and soldiers were blocking the advance of the caravan. That, of course, also blocked the commercial traffic and trucks heading through the region, through the Agua Caliente border. So there was a sizable group, estimates range from between sort of 800 to more than 1,000 of people from that initial group of, you know, 3,000-4,000 Hondurans who pushed through the police and military lines on Saturday, January 16th.
Thousands of soldiers and police were set up inside Honduran borders, but the vast majority were set up in Guatemala, preventing the advancement of the caravan into interior Guatemala and obviously preventing them from heading to the north where the border of Mexico is located. This is Bartolo Fuentes describing the border wall that has turned into a militarized human wall that has been pushed farther south beyond the U.S.-Mexico border, creating a barrier for migrants at every step of the way.
The border wall is built, right? The places at the border that don't have a wall have a natural barrier, like the desert, that is not easy to cross, and mountains, rivers. The wall isn't really the problem. It's the anti-immigrant attitude that the same police, the government, and local government have in some states where there is practically total persecution against migrants. We say, for example, in Arizona, they wanted to convict an academic migrant activist to 20 years in prison for putting water for migrants in the desert border regions. These types of attitudes are prevalent and strong. But here, there are other issues. The policies that are anti-migrant, those that make Mexico militarize its southern border, that have Guatemala beat migrants with batons, and has Honduras erect police barriers on the highways to prevent migrants from leaving. So Biden is going to stop the construction of the wall between Mexico and the United States. But is he also going to stop the human border walls that the U.S. has constructed as well? Like thousands of police and military that have been dispatched in Mexico and Guatemala and in Honduras? This is an important question, because the Safe Third Country Agreement is nothing more than the U.S. charging others to repress migrants before they arrive at the Mexico-U.S. border.
The anticipation of Biden taking power in the United States had generated a new sense of hope amongst the participants in the caravan. potentially false hope, but hope nevertheless, that people who are desperate and that travel north will not be treated as badly by state security forces, both at the border and along their journey. When Biden took power on January 20th, the road blockade was still at a deadlock. This is Sandra Cuff describing what was happening between the migrants and refugees and the Guatemalan state security forces inside Guatemala at that moment.
So when I got there on Monday morning, the rumor that everyone, at least in that area of, you know, the group who was on the highway closest to military and police lines, the widespread belief there was that somebody from the Biden campaign had phoned down, unclear to who, the previous evening and said that as soon as Biden was in office, he would essentially ensure that people would be welcomed along the route and at the U.S. border. That is, of course, completely false. Biden has taken office. The U.S. is still coordinating with Mexico and Guatemala, still celebrating Guatemala's, you know, quote-unquote exceptional efforts to combat quote-unquote irregular migration, as in celebrating the militarized response to the migrant caravan. So while U.S. immigration policy in the U.S. has seen, you know, already within Biden's first acts upon taking office, he rolled back some of the more hardline travel bans and other restrictions on immigration and asylum, and also, you know, has pledged to propose legislation to provide a pathway to legal status for the millions of people who have been living undocumented in the United States. Those are all incredibly, incredibly important acts, obviously, that impact the lives of millions of people. However, the reality and perspective in Central America is quite different. So those measures, including a stay on many deportations, including the plan to provide a pathway to status for people, none of that applies to anybody who would be arriving after November 1st of last year. So that's right before the hurricanes swept through Central America, hitting Honduras the hardest. It's sort of right around the time that people fleeing Central America, the numbers have been picking back up after so long of a sort of slowdown, you know, when all of these border restrictions and lockdown measures were really slowing down migrations.
People hearing this story might think that the difficulty of the journey would make for a sober experience the entire way. But the truth is, those who are fleeing Honduras have agency. And despite the situation being so hard and so difficult, Hondurans find a way to keep going, to keep each other motivated and also keep each other happy.
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman with IBW Local 124 and secretary of the Greater Kansas City Industrial Workers of the World. Established in 1869, just 4 years after the passage of the 13th Amendment, the National Labor Union, more commonly known as the Colored National Labor Union, CNLU, was formed by African Americans to organize their labor collectively on a national level. The CNLU, like other labor unions in the United States, was created with the goal of improving the working conditions and quality of life for its members. African Americans were then excluded from existing labor unions, such as when white workers formed the original National Labor Union, NLU, in 1866. William Silvis, president of the original NLU, made a speech in which he argued that there should be no distinction of race or nationality within the ranks of his organization. In 1869, several black delegates were invited to the annual meeting of the NLU, among them Isaac Myers, a prominent organizer of African American laborers. At the convention, he spoke eloquently for solidarity, saying that white and black workers ought to organize together for higher wages and a comfortable standard of living. During the 1869 original NLU convention, a motion was passed claiming that the organization did not recognize color. However, many labor unions ignored this ruling and continued to remain segregated. Due to the use of black laborers as strikebreakers, there was a great deal of resentment from mostly white unions who saw them as an enemy. It should also be noted that this resentment went both ways, as white strikebreakers were also often employed when black workers went on strike. This strategy of the ruling class to wedge workers apart to prevent their uniting against them has long been a popular one. Of course, another issue was that the white working class was and is the base for violent white supremacist groups. There was also disagreements at that time between black and white workers regarding the priorities of labor unions, with white workers more focused on establishing political power and currency reform, while black workers were more concerned with the ability to own and develop property. As such, black workers broke apart from the NLU and had their own convention later that year, resulting in the creation of the Colored National Labor Union. Ultimately, black labor leaders decided that if they're not going to be given their deserved seats at the NLU, they would just have to start their own. Founded in December 1869 by an assembly of 214 African-American mechanics, engineers, artisans, tradesmen, and tradeswomen, and their supporters in Washington, D.C., this organization was created in pursuit of equal representation for African-Americans in the workforce. Isaac Myers was elected as its first president. During the first convention of the CNLU in December 1869, delegates wrote a petition to Congress. This petition asked for Congress to split public land within the South into farmland to be used by low-income African-American farmers. It also requested that black farmers be given a low-interest loan from the government. Another petition was drafted and sent to Congress in 1871, requesting the commission of an investigation into conditions of affairs in the Southern states. Unfortunately, little response or effects resulted from these efforts. The CNLU also established the Bureau of Labor, based in Washington, D.C. The Bureau of Labor was designed to assist workers of color in organizing throughout the country. As president of the CNLU, Isaac Myers traveled throughout the country, encouraging the organization of black workers and attempting to convince white labor unions to allow workers of color within their organizations. On his trips, he often specifically focused on mechanics and mechanics unions, as he believed that white mechanic labor unions were specifically designed to withhold specific positions from black workers. Unfortunately, upon the CNLU's second annual convention, Myers stated that the organization was not as successful as they had hoped. He claimed that the education and financial resources provided by the CNLU and the Bureau of Labor were insufficient and noted that the Ku Klux Klan's power in the South prevented the organization of black laborers in certain areas. Civil rights activist Frederick Douglass was elected the president of the CNLU in 1872, and his newspaper, The National New Era, was chosen as the official press organ of the CNLU. The CNLU sent delegates to the 1870 National Labor Convention of the white-dominated NLU, but following the NLU's rejection of black abolitionist attorney John M. Langston's admission during the conference, the CNLU broke off most of its contact with the all-white NLU. While Myers had warned against the CNLU becoming a primarily political body as opposed to a trade union party, the election of Frederick Douglass in 1871 reflected the influx of political figures within the organization. Over time, the CNLU became more and more politically focused, to the point where it essentially began to function as a branch of the Republican Party, resulting in less trade union focus and activity and less contact with trade unionists across the country. By 1872, the CNLU had ceased most of its operations and would eventually disband, just as the mostly white NLU had when their designation as a political party fractured their organization. These first experiments and national organization, while enjoying relatively brief lifespans, would greatly inform the leaders and other members involved in them on how to organize better next time as the Knights of Labor. This has been an adaptation of the Wikipedia article on the CNLU. Have a great evening, everyone, and thanks for listening.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. All Souls UU Forum, Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, with Alice Kitchen and Carol Coles. It's Sunday, February 11th, 10 a.m. You can go to the All Souls UU Church website to get the link. Stand Up KC Car Caravan for $15, minimum wage to Senator Roy Blunt's office. This is next Tuesday, February 16th, 10:30 to 1 p.m. Meet at St. Mark's Church at 10:30. That's at 38th and Troost, and you can decorate your car there and start off on the caravan. Our Revolution KC meeting and presentation by Jeanette Jones on whitewashing black history, Tuesday, February 16th, 8 p.m. Go to the Our Revolution KC webpage to find the link. And Kansas and Missouri Legislative Update. Speakers are Dinah Sykes and Ethan Corson from Kansas and Barbara Ann Washington and Greg Razor from Missouri. That's Sunday the 21st from 5 to 6 p.m. To register, go to the HAP HAP KC web Facebook page. And finally, Jobs with Justice legislative update, Wednesday, February 24th, 2 p.m. To register, go to the Missouri Jobs with Justice webpage. That's it for the calendar, and that's it for the show. Tune in next week. Our show is going to be What's Cooking in the Missouri and Kansas Legislatures with Representatives Wes Rogers and Tom Holland. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which tonight is Shots in the Night, How the West Was Warped.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
For the common man's rights to be in the working class is good enough for me. Story, when it all comes down, I'll be remembered as the guy with his feet. side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage is something to be proud of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.